So as I mentioned earlier, we're working through Exodus, and our passage this morning is Exodus 34, verses 10 to 35. You can see from the way the passage is set out in the ESV that it comprises two main sections, and that's how we're going to divide up the passage. We're going to look at it in those two sections under two headings. And first of all, then, this morning, sample stipulations. That's our first heading, sample stipulations. And this is verses 10 to 28. So the material in these verses is law, lots of you shalls and you shall nots. But not only that, it's law which God has already given to Moses in earlier chapters. You may well have recognized that and seen that as we were reading through those verses earlier. So why then is God giving it to Moses again? Well, the answer is that something has happened in between, namely the incident with the golden calf. Now, we modern evangelical readers of the Bible may not get excited about law, but we should. It's a wonderful thing that God gives Israel his law. He doesn't give Egypt his law, or Edom, or Moab, or any of the other nations, because he isn't in a covenant relationship with them, but he is with Israel. That's why Israel is given God's law as a consequence of this extraordinary covenant bond. But this is the thing. The incident with the golden calf, it places a huge question mark over that covenant bond. Israel has violated the covenant bond. If we think of God's covenant with Israel in marital terms, as of course the Bible encourages us to do, then Israel, during her very honeymoon, has been found in bed with another lover. That's what the golden calf episode amounts to. It's brazen adultery. Israel has broken the covenant. Surely that's it. Surely God will walk away wanting nothing more to do with Israel. It seems inevitable. But what happens here in verses 10 to 28 of our passage? Moses spends 40 days and 40 nights with God on Mount Sinai, verse 28, just as he had done before the golden calf. And God gives Moses law, the very same law he had given him before the golden calf. What's going on? Well, the cheated partner in this relationship is graciously reestablishing the broken covenant, resetting it, as though the infidelity had never occurred. Verse 10, behold, I am making a covenant. And so that's why all this law in these verses is appearing again. It's not some kind of mistake, an accidental repetition or something. Rather, God gave it to Moses when he established his covenant with Israel in the first place, and God gives it to Moses once more now as he reestablishes his covenant with Israel following the treachery of the golden calf. Now, while this re-establishment of the covenant probably involved God going through the whole of his law for a second time with Moses, Moses doesn't give us readers the whole thing all over again. Rather, he gives us a flavor here in verses 10 to 28. That's why my heading is sample stipulations. These verses comprise a few sample stipulations from this second giving of the law to Moses. And because we've encountered them before, we're not going to expound them this morning in a detailed and comprehensive way. But there are some fresh touches here. Material that isn't repeated verbatim from the first time it was given a few chapters ago. And those fresh touches give rise to a couple of things to which I just want to briefly draw your attention. First of all, a process. A process. So notice the stipulations in verses 12 to 17 relate to the danger of the Israelites going after other gods once they're in the promised land. But what's fascinating is how it is envisaged that that might happen. And it's not then that there's just going to be something in the air in Canaan, some kind of intoxicating particles, and on breathing them in, the Israelites will have this crazy compulsion to bow down to idols. No. In verses 15 to 17, a very gradual, gentle, unspectacular process is outlined. It begins with the Israelites making a covenant with those Canaanites who aren't immediately wiped out, but who carry on living alongside them in the land. What's in view with this making of a covenant is probably something pretty banal and unremarkable. Making a covenant with them in relation to trade, perhaps. We'll supply you with oil, you'll supply us with wood. That kind of thing. Or maybe making a covenant regarding boundaries. That area is where you'll do your farming, this area is where we'll do our farming. You get the picture. Verse 15, I'm saying, is talking about very ordinary covenant making arising out of the practicalities of living alongside these people. Why should that be a problem? Well, in pagan cultures in the ancient Near East, you never did anything without relating it directly and explicitly to the gods. And that included making covenants about trade or boundaries or whatever. You ratified the covenant in the context of an act of worship. And so here are these Canaanites then, and they are entering into a covenant with some Israelites in relation to something or other, something banal, as I've just said. And they are ratifying that covenant then in an act of worship. What are they going to do? Well, of course, they're going to invite along to the act of worship the Israelites with whom they are making the covenant. Now, this act of worship then, what does it involve? Well, two things according to verse 15. Whoring and sacrificing. And the whoring isn't metaphorical. The Israelites, who, as I said a moment ago, are covenantally married to Yahweh, they can metaphorically be described sometimes in the Old Testament as whoring after other gods. The Canaanites can't possibly whore after their own gods in that metaphorical sense. No, this whoring is literal. It's actually engaging in wild sexual activity in acts of worship. As for the sacrificing that's mentioned there in verse 15, listen to how one commentator describes it. Although the Israelites were permitted in their law to eat meat whenever they chose, the usual pagan practice was to eat meat only as part of a worship sacrifice to an idol. That way, a portion of the sacrifice would go to the idol as a burnt offering, a portion to the priest representing the idol, and the remainder to the worshipper and his family. Accordingly, the more frequently one ate meat, since it was always eaten in connection with worship, and the more meat one ate, since thereby the god's portion was increased, the more likely one could curry favor with the gods. Pigging out thus typified pagan sacrifices. Heavy drinking and drunkenness also were considered proper in idol worship feasts because debauching oneself was simply part of being generous to a god. So here are these Israelites. And because of this banal covenant that they're entering into, they've been invited along to this covenant ratifying act of worship. And they see then the sexual stuff going on, and they know that that's beyond the pale for them as Yahweh's people, and so they refrain. But the eating, well, that seems less toxic. And after all, they can't exempt themselves from everything in this act of worship. Otherwise, it will seem to the Canaanites as though they're uncommitted to the covenant that they're making together. And so, the end of verse 15, you eat of his sacrifice. The Israelites, at this act of worship, they join in with the eating. Now, eating in Eastern cultures now and then is, of course, a highly social business. Relationships are formed and developed in the context of eating. Thus, these Israelites then joining in the eating at this act of worship, they start to get to know their Canaanite fellow diners. And here's this one Israelite family then that we'll imagine. And they discover that this Canaanite family that they happen to be at the same table with, they have things in common with them. In particular, both families have teenagers. And the Israelite family, they have a teenage son. The Canaanite family, on the other hand, they have a teenage daughter. And for a while, the conversation is light-hearted about the differences between boys and girls and all that kind of stuff. But then over dessert, the Canaanite parents suddenly shift gear from the quips and banter, and they get all serious. "Look," they say, "we want to arrange a good marriage for our daughter. Would you consider her as a bride for your son?" And by this stage in the meal and in the developing relationship and with a good deal of drink down their throats as well, it would be terribly uncivil for the Israelite parents to respond, "You must be joking. We don't want your daughter for our son." And so the marriage is arranged, and in due course, the wedding takes place. Then, in keeping with ancient Near Eastern convention, the new bride comes to live with her husband in his parents' home. And the day she moves in, her Israelite parents-in-law are somewhat surprised at how much stuff she's bringing with her. "What's all this? You've got a lot of clothes, haven't you?" "Oh, no, 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 those things in the boxes, they're my gods. I've got to bring those with me, of course." And so in this Israelite house, there's now a room that's essentially a shrine, an installation of pagan gods in it. Verse 16, "You take of their daughters for your sons and their daughters whore after their gods and make your sons whore after their gods." And you see then this process that I'm talking about. Beginning with this seemingly innocuous little covenant, and one thing leads to another, and there's a slow entanglement until eventually in verse 17 the Israelites are making for themselves gods of cast metal. And I'm laboring the point then this morning because I think it has relevance beyond just the Israelites slipping into idolatry in the land of Canaan. For all God's people, in all ages, all kinds of sin work often in this same way. That is to say, they creep up on us. They take over our lives, not suddenly and all at once, but slowly and steadily and unshockingly. And it means then that when engaging in self-examination, as we should as Christian people, when engaging in self-examination, we must be rigorous and probing. It isn't a case of, am I sleeping with anyone who is not my spouse? No, I'm not, so everything's hunky-dory. We must ask ourselves, could I possibly be on the road to sleeping with someone who is not my spouse, being gradually led there in small stages, each of which by itself seems harmless? It's not a case of, am I at the point where I'm willing to sacrifice anything and everything in my life for career success? No, I'm not, so all is well. We must ask ourselves, could I possibly be moving slowly toward that point? Is that the trajectory I'm on, even if I'm not yet very far along that trajectory? You know how you go to the doctors and you're sitting there in the waiting room and there are all these rather unnerving posters on the wall urging you to check yourself, to scrutinize various parts of your anatomy for any lumps and bumps and abnormalities. And the posters, and they aren't asking, is your body emaciated? Have you been bedridden for weeks and stopped eating and drinking? That's the kind of medical check that we men like. As long as we can say no to those questions, then we can convince ourselves that we're in perfect health. But the posters are going much further back than that, aren't they? They're asking, could you actually be on the road to one day being at death's door, emaciated and bedridden, because there's a dangerous lump somewhere that isn't being dealt with properly? And as Christians then, in the moral realm, we have to take that approach, the approach of those posters. Ask yourself this morning, are there any lumps or bumps in my life that are not being dealt with? That are easily ignored at present, but may seriously imperil my Christian discipleship and my relationship with God further down the line? We need to ask those probing and rigorous self examinatory questions. So that's the process here. And then also I just wanted to draw your attention in verses 10 to 28 to a principle. A principle. A couple of weeks ago I mentioned a Christian expression that worries me a bit. I've prayed about it. Fine in itself, of course, but the way in which it's often used, I think, can be concerning. Well, here's another. God can't mean dot, dot, dot. God can't mean dot, dot, dot. So I'm thinking of a situation where we're faced with some biblical command, and observing that command seems to incur too much of a cost. It seems an unreasonable demand, and so we say, God can't mean in these circumstances we have to do that or not do that or whatever the command is. Look at verse 21 here, where we read, "For 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest." And you can imagine then an Israelite farmer, and week after week he observes that command and he keeps the Sabbath rest. But then comes one of the really busy times in the agricultural year, harvest perhaps. And during harvest, everything is frenetic. And it's hugely urgent to get the crops in before bad weather comes. And losing a whole day in that context is such a big thing, such a big deal. And so the Israelite farmer reasons, when God says rest on the Sabbath day, he means usually, normally, as a general rule, but God can't mean rest on the Sabbath day in these circumstances. That's unreasonable. Is that farmer right to reason like that? Well, no, he's not, because verse 21 continues. In ploughing time and in harvest you shall rest. And the principle I'm talking about then and flagging up for you is this. God's commands mean what they say. They don't mean behave like this when it's reasonable and costless to do so. They mean behave like this. And so we must beware the God cannot mean attitude. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, 2 Corinthians 6:14. But God cannot mean that in this situation that I'm in, I should forego what may be my one chance of happiness in marrying this person with whom I'm so compatible in every other area. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, 2 Corinthians 9:7. But God can't mean that in this situation I'm in, my financial circumstances being so impossibly tight, I should give regularly to the church. Everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart, Matthew 5:28. But God cannot mean that I, in my situation as a red-blooded young adult with hormones raging, must deny myself even just low-level visual titillation. Bless those who persecute you, Romans 12:14. But God cannot mean do that in this kind of situation, where someone hates me and targets me so intensely. And so we could go on, couldn't we? It's easy, is it not, to slip into that kind of reasoning. And just one other thing quickly, going back to the specific situation of verse 21. For the Israelite farmer approaching harvest time, the Sabbath rest command would be somewhat challenging, a formidable command perhaps. For someone else, however, it would be fantastic. For whom would it be fantastic? Well, for the farm labourer, for the hired worker, we saw those figures in some of the earlier Sinai laws. Because for that man, for the farm labourer, without this command here in Exodus 34:21, his workload is just going to go through the roof at harvest time. And he's going to be required to be out in those fields 24/7. And he's a lowly member of society who can't argue with his employer, or otherwise he'll just be kicked out. And his family need to be fed, and he has no savings in the bank. And so harvest time is going to be this nightmare for him. this terrible ordeal that he dreads throughout the year when he's going to get no sleep and he's going to be working, working, working non-stop. But this beautiful law protects that man. And I think we're meant to understand that that is one of God's main motives in giving this law. He isn't inflexible about the Sabbath here because he's so remote from life on earth that he doesn't understand the logistics of agriculture and the urgency of getting in the harvest. That's how the farmer might be tempted to think. No, he's inflexible about the Sabbath here because he's so involved in life on earth that he understands perfectly the hardship that harvest will entail for the most vulnerable, for those who are most easily taken advantage of. Verse 21, therefore, is an insight into God's heart. And it's probably no coincidence that it comes so soon after verse 17 with its reference to gods of cast metal. At Time Out recently, we were in Hosea, the last chapter of Hosea, chapter 14. And there you have God giving his people words to bring to him in repentance. Hosea 14, 2, take with you words and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity, accept what is good. We will pay with bulls the vows of our lips. Assyria shall not save us. We will not ride on horses. We will say no more our God to the work of our hands. And then there's this one more line at the end of verse 3. In you, that's Yahweh, in you the orphan finds mercy. You think, well, what's that line doing there? Why, in renouncing their idols, might the Israelites also exclaim, in you, Yahweh, the orphan finds mercy? Well, because, you see, they would be saying, you don't get that kind of thing with the stupid idols that we've been worshipping these past years. With idols, you get a nice bit of metalwork, a lovely paint job sometimes, some decent welding. But that's all you get. You don't get in them a being who is compassionate and tender-hearted toward the most vulnerable in society, toward the poor orphans. And so he goes on in verse 8, Yahweh himself says, Ephraim, what have I to do with idols? In other words, I'm nothing like them. It is I who answer and look after you. What idol ever did that? And I think we probably have the same logic here in Exodus 34. Verse 21 is confirming that gods of cast metal aren't only wrong, they are pathetic. What god of cast metal ever cared for the rights of farm laborers and hired workers out in the fields at harvest time? But Yahweh cares for those people. That is the God of the Bible. If you're being tempted this morning to drift away from the God of the Bible, I say to you, where else will you find a God like this one? Where else will you find a God who is so deeply, irrepressibly concerned for widows and orphans and farm laborers? What a beautiful God is the God of the Bible. So sample stipulations, but then secondly and more briefly this morning, shining skin. Shining skin, and this is verses 29 to 35. And the shining skin, of course, belongs to Moses. Verse 29, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. And this incident then, it's intriguing and memorable, but just by itself, I'm not sure it would detain us too long when reading Exodus. We'd probably say, oh, well, that's an interesting little episode, but then we would move on to chapter 35. But what changes everything with respect to this passage is an exposition that we have of it in the New Testament. Normally, New Testament expositions of passages in Exodus, as we've seen over the last few weeks, are to be found in the book of Hebrews. In this case, it's to be found in 2 Corinthians. We read it earlier, 2 Corinthians chapters 3 and 4. And I'm going to just spend in the last few minutes of our time pretty much based there in 2 Corinthians 3 and 4. And the meaning then of that passage is unlocked when we understand one key point, which is this. For Paul, Moses' shining face as he descends the mountain represents something. It stands for something else. Namely, it represents what Paul calls in that passage the Old Covenant. The Old Covenant, as most of you know, is the way that the relationship between God and Israel was arranged from Mount Sinai when it was established and for about 1,500 years thereafter. Moses' shining face represents that, the Old Covenant. You see, the Old Covenant had a glory about it. But like the glory in Moses' face, it was crucially a reflected glory. Think of being on a beach on the west coast of Britain, perhaps Wales, perhaps Scotland, and it's evening, and there's a magnificent sunset taking place. And as you stand on that beach, you can look out across the water and see the sun itself in all its burning crimson glory. Or alternatively, you can turn the other way and you can look at the rocks at the back of the beach. And I've certainly had this experience, and perhaps you have as well. Those rocks then at the back of the beach, they also have a crimson glow about them. But of course, those rocks are not generating that crimson glow themselves. It's the reflected glory of the sun that's setting. And in the same way then, the cells in Moses' skin were not generating this brightness in our passage. It was the reflected glory of the one in whose presence Moses had just spent 40 days and 40 nights. And in the same way, Paul is saying, the sacrifices and rituals and festivals of the Old Covenant didn't generate their own glory. Rather, they reflected the glory of someone who would come later. They reflected the glory of Jesus Christ. Take Passover, for instance. The glory of Passover derived from Christ. Without Christ, it was just a silly annual ritual in which you made a mess of your doorframes. It derived its glory and its luster from the coming Lamb of God who would shed his blood for his people's redemption. That's what Paul means then in 2 Corinthians 3, verses 10 and 11. He says there, what once had glory, that is the Old Covenant sacrifices and rituals and festivals, has come to have no glory at all because of the glory that surpasses it, namely the glory of Christ, which is what it was reflecting all along. If what was being brought to an end came with glory, much more will what is permanent have glory. In verse 13, Paul refers to the outcome of what was being brought to an end. So what was being brought to an end is the Old Covenant. Outcome is probably better translated goal. And the goal then of the Old Covenant was Christ. It was all pointing and leading to him, and it was his glory that it glowed a little in the reflection of. So that's the key point to understand here. And on that basis then, that Moses' shining face, shining with a reflected glory, represents the Old Covenant that also shines with a reflected glory. On that basis, Paul emphasizes two things, one sad, one wonderful. He emphasizes the unbelief of Israel, and he emphasizes the greatness of the new covenant. So first of all, the unbelief of Israel. I mean, you'd have thought, wouldn't you, going back to our passage, going back to Sinai, you'd have thought that the Israelites, as Moses comes down with this shining face, you'd have thought that they would have enjoyed the spectacle of this reflected glory in Moses' face. But they don't, do they? As one commentator puts it, to them, it looked terrible in both senses of that word, causing terror and unpleasant to view. And so instead of gazing at it, they have to look instead at something that we are all grimly familiar with since COVID. They had to look at a face covering. a dull strip of material. And Paul is saying then, here in 2 Corinthians, that in the same way, tragically, the reflected glory of Christ in the Old Covenant was for most of those 1500 years unpleasant to the Israelites, to most of the Israelites, not all of them, but to most of the Israelites throughout those 1500 years, the reflected glory of Christ in the Old Covenant was unpleasant to view. He says in verse 14 of chapter 3, their minds were hardened. So that instead of gazing on that reflected glory of Christ in the Old Covenant, they saw instead just religious rituals to be maintained for their own sake. Passover at this time of year, the ingathering festival at this time of year, burnt offerings, fellowship offerings, just things for their own sake. Effectively, they were looking at a dull strip of material, a veil. In fact, worse. Because they didn't see the glory, the reflected glory of Christ in the Old Covenant became for them not merely gloryless, but deadly, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 3. He talks about it killing, verse 6, and in verse 9 it being a ministry of condemnation. And Paul says, doesn't he, that actually it's still the case in his own day. As he's writing, he says in verse 15 that still, the Jews of his day, they can't see in the Old Covenant the reflected glory of Christ. All they can see is rules and festivals and rituals and sacrifices. Just religion, more religion, more religion. They can't see Christ's reflected glory in it. And you go to Gateshead today and you see thousands of Jews there. We're still in exactly the situation as when Paul was writing here, who are very familiar with the Old Covenant, but all they can see is rules and rituals and rites. They can't see the reflected glory of Christ in any of it, which is why we need to pray what we were singing in that hymn just now, the veil of darkness rend in two, which hides Messiah from their view. So Paul, he emphasizes the unbelief of Israel, but then the other thing he emphasizes is the greatness of the new covenant. The greatness of the new covenant. I said then that the old covenant arrangement continued for 1500 years. We are beyond those 1500 years. Our relationship with God is not based this morning on the Sinai material. No longer do we have sacrifices and rituals and festivals, all those phenomena that reflected Christ's glory. We live in the new covenant. What does that mean? Well, it means, Paul says simply in verse 18, it means that we behold the glory of the Lord. The thing itself. Not the glory of the Lord reflected dimly in Passover and in the Day of Atonement and all that kind of stuff. But we behold the glory of the Lord itself. And we're back, of course, now to where we were at the end of last week's sermon. That's what we were stressing then. And this is why, then, and really the whole context here, in 2 Corinthians, I mean, is Paul talking about how, despite all his sufferings, he revels in being a minister of the new covenant. And this is why, despite his sufferings, which he will go on to describe in great detail in the remainder of chapter 4, this is why, despite his sufferings, he revels in being a minister of the new covenant. Because in the new covenant, then, Paul is not a priest administering sacrifices that reflect a little bit of Christ's glory. But in the new covenant, Paul is proclaiming Jesus Christ, chapter 4, verse 5. He's proclaiming the glory itself. He's offering that. He's showing that to men and women and boys and girls. And this then is the wonder of our service this morning. This is the wonder of being a new covenant congregation of God's people. In this service this morning, it means that we behold the glory of the Lord. We don't mess around with a few rituals that have a bit of a glow from Christ's glory that hasn't yet been revealed. But this morning, we gather together to gaze corporately on the glory of the Lord. And you say, oh, but how can that be? Christ is in heaven. Christ is in heaven and we're just in this ordinary room. How can that be? Well, Paul explains and he talks about the Spirit, doesn't he? Yes, Christ is in heaven, but the Spirit is not in heaven. The Spirit is here. And he talks about how in this new covenant era, then Christ has so, as it were, tied himself to the Spirit. That wherever the Spirit is, he conveys Christ to that place and to that people. So that Christ isn't confined in heaven this morning. But wherever the Spirit is, the Lord is there in some sense. And the Spirit enables us to have a real experience this morning then of gazing on the beauty of Jesus Christ. Which, notice, Paul also brings out in verse 18, has a transforming effect on us ourselves. This fascinating language of us being transformed from one degree of glory to another. Normally for Paul, glory refers to physical resurrection glory, and it's exclusively a future reality. But here he talks about us experiencing something of glory now, not physically, obviously, but in our characters. And it's a biblical principle, isn't it, that the sight of God is itself a transforming thing. We shall see him and be like him, 1 John 3. And as we behold the glory of the Lord in our new covenant worship and devotion, then there's a transforming effect that that has on us. It's one of the reasons why we in our holiness can exceed the levels of holiness that was possible for old covenant believers. Because they were gazing on a reflected glory that lacked the transforming power that gazing on the true glory of Christ itself has. But all of this raises a question. And the question is this then. How come people can come perhaps to a church service? They can hear then, as Paul puts it in chapter 4 verse 5, Jesus Christ being proclaimed. Being proclaimed very directly. They're not having to come and watch a Passover ritual take place. They're hearing the direct, undiluted proclamation of Jesus Christ and his glory, and yet they can walk out having seen nothing of the glory of Jesus Christ. How is that? Well, in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 4, Paul moves on, doesn't he, to talk about a different kind of veil that people in the New Covenant era experience, a satanic veil, a veil imposed by the person he calls the God of this world. The God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers. We're very aware of that sometimes, aren't we? When you explain the gospel to someone, perhaps, and you explain it as clearly as you possibly can, as compellingly as you possibly can, or you're perhaps sitting alongside someone who isn't a Christian in a Christian service, and you hear the gospel just being proclaimed so compellingly, and you think, this person cannot possibly walk out of here without having seen at last the glory of Jesus Christ. And they walk out of there still not having seen the glory of Christ, because there's this veil, this satanic veil. And it's why then we need to pray for people. It's not enough simply to present them with Jesus Christ, but we need to pray that as Jesus Christ is presented, as Jesus Christ is presented in Christianity Explored, in the Holiday Bible Club, in our own personal conversations with people, as Jesus Christ is proclaimed, there will be this powerful, divine shattering of the veil, so that people will see in the face of Jesus Christ, the glory of God. Amen.